Folks, welcome to the second lecture in our seventh seminar series. This should in fact be the third lecture, but as some of you will know, we had to cancel before Christmas because of the inclement weather, and I'll come back to that at the end of this session. A couple of things. First of all, there is no fire drill planned for the duration of our stay here, so if the fire alarm goes off, we have to leave. There's an exit at the back of the room there, and one to my left, to your right here. That takes you out down the main staircase, and the gathering point is the coffee shop in St. Neil's Square. So if we need to leave, we'll just have to do that. At the end of the session, we've got coffee and bite to eat in the lounge, so if you've got time to stay for that, you'd be very welcome to do that. So thank you very much for coming. We've got a live web link, as you will have heard, through to Hazel Henderson and her team in Florida, and to some of our colleagues in Fife who are listening in. So we're in three locations at the moment. We are absolutely delighted that Hazel has agreed to speak in the series, and we're delighted too that it's going to be our first web seminar. So we've never done this before. So this is an exciting occasion for me, as it is for everybody else, I hope. Hazel Henderson will be known to many of you. I first came across Hazel's work in 1978 when I read a book that she had written called Creating Alternative Futures. And it piqued my interest, and I find myself almost 40 years later working on alternative futures. So I don't know how much impact it had on me, but it certainly had an impact. Hazel was born in Bristol some time ago, and that will come through in her talk. And I think of her, as many other people do think of her, as a leading global authority on economics, finance, as if real world matters. So Hazel has really spent her whole adult life trying to get that kind of thinking about economics, finance and the environment into real conversations based on what people need in their lives rather than simply shareholder value or profit maximisation. She's been running her own television station since 2004. I don't know if you've had a look at that, but if you haven't, I urge you to do it. The television station is called ethicalmarkets.com. And there's a plethora, a huge amount of really interesting material on these topics there. She's held a number of academic positions over her lifetime too. She was a University of California lecturer in Santa Barbara. And she held the Horace Albright Chair in Conservation at the University of California in Berkeley. And she's on the boards of several prestigious and I think really interesting journals, as well as a number of different think tanks in the UK and abroad. Her list of publications is very wide-ranging, as you would expect, of somebody of her interests and experience, and they range from publications for the United Nations, the Green Economy, and most of you will have heard, I hope, of the Calvert-Henderson Quality of Life Indicators, which she and others were trying to persuade us to use as far back as the year 2000. The list is almost endless. And somebody said about Hazel, Hazel Henderson is the original thinker of her generation. She breaks the new ground and plants the seeds, and we follow in her wake. She's going to talk to us today about transforming finance and trying to recognise the global financial system as a commons and look at the principles that guide finance and talk to us about how we might become more actively involved in socially responsible investment in a city like Glasgow. Hazel.
Thank you, Andrew. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here with you all, and I know for you it's dinner time, well, past that, so good evening. And I am really the full time now, not only on the whole issue of transforming finance, but also how you grow the green economy. So I want to say that IFF is really a group of kindred spirits. And as I was going over the website, which I love, I found all the references to Don Michael. And Don Michael was a friend of mine, and so this was a particular pleasure. Don and I were able to spend time together in China in 1986, where we were both invited to a conference on creativity at Chiao Tong University. And so I have happy memories of being with Don and talking about the conceptual emergency that we humans are faced with the darn clever, and yet we haven't really figured out how to manage all of this new technology that we've created. So Don and I would be walking on the Great Wall and at the Summer Palace and all over Beijing and Shanghai together. So this is a wonderful reconnection. And also, when I read the list of the members of IFF and found my friends David Peake, David Lorimer, Napier Collins. So anyway, I want to thank Graham Lester, who I don't know if he's there, and particularly Andrew for helping to set all of this up. Many thanks. So back then, about in the 1980s, I used this visual, which I created, just to kind of get a conversation going about how we connect all the dots and how we go beyond that, the Cartesian scientific worldview, which was so productive, in creating all of the technologies that we have. But now is the time to reintegrate our knowledge, and we need to look at redistribution, because that's what nature does, recycling all elements and structures all the time. We need to go to heterarchy from all of the hierarchical models, and complementarity, the Asian approach, and to remember that uncertainty and change are really the only certainty that we will ever know. So the need to transform finance, that really is more urgent than ever when I began writing in the 1960s and when Andrew found that book of mine, which was a compilation of articles, Creating Alternative Futures. And I began as an activist, an environmental activist in New York City in the 60s, creating a group called Citizens for Clean Air. And Senator Robert Kennedy was our senator, and he was running for president. And so we contacted him, and we took him a helicopter ride around New York City, showing all the air pollution. And we told him that we were pushing to get the gross national product index changed to include subtracting pollution and all of those diseconomies and disservices and disamenities that were coming along from the traditional measurement of economic growth. And then in the early 70s, I ran into Professor Nicholas Georgescu Roygen, and he was a brilliant Hungarian. And he wrote a book called The Entropy Law and the Economic Profit, which I found was very, very important. In fact, I thought, my gosh, this is the new Keynes. And I wrote a review of that in the Harvard Business Review in 1971. And of course, Nicholas and I became friends. And then I spent time in Washington at the U.S. Office of Technology Assessment from 1974 to 1980, which was a new discipline. And the whole idea was, let's try to get ahead of all these technologies before they escape out of that barn door. And let's look at all the social and environmental consequences in the future if we don't assess these technologies very carefully. That was a huge formative experience for me. And it enabled me to really tune in to the green economy and the great transition that I realized was going on from the fossil fuel era and the early industrial age, which began in Britain, a lot of it in Scotland, and that we would now be moving to a much more information-rich, broader view of how to work with technology that work with nature, and of course that remains the passion of my life. And I helped to organize E.F. Schumacher's first lecture in the U.S. in the 70s, and of course he became a lifelong friend and used to stay at my place, and so that was a great thrill. And then I became very friendly with the physicist, Richard Capra, during the time I was at OTA. And so I wrote The Politics of the Solar Age at the same time that he was working on his book, Turning Point, which he hired me to do a review of what was wrong with economics, which I didn't know this.
Yes, we can.
Hello?
Yes, sound great on my end, people.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, we're okay, I sent you.
We pop that noise? Yeah, okay, great. So Christoph Clapper and I also became lifelong friends, and of course, the subject of finance. We have to remember that around the world, there's always been two main ways of transacting. The money-based way in the industrial societies, in yen, pounds, and dollars, and euros, and whatnot. And yet, in most of the rest of the world, people operated on barter, mutual aid, cooperation, owner-built housing, and the caring, sharing, what I call the love economy. And at least 50% of all productive work in the world is still done in this unpaid love economy, which is completely missing from the economic textbooks. So let's start by remembering that. And then let's also remember the evolution of the role of money related to human understanding and our widening awareness of the world. And of course, we started off, you know, pre-industrial society, 3000 BC, you know, clay tablets and shells and cattle and metal tokens were money. And then in the early industrial era, silver and gold became a basis for transactions and money. And then in the later industrial period, most money units were based on the gold standard for international transactions. And those transactions were growing as more and more became a global society. And then we now have been dealing, you know, since OPEC and the crisis of oil the last 30 years or so, we've begun to realize that really money only has value as it is related to actual energy and material in the real world. And so governments began printing money. Maybe we've all noticed that. And we call it fiat currency, where it's based on nothing but the government's promise to pay. And now what's happening, because of the internet, and all of the communications media and social networks, we're now being able to trade with just pure information. So we don't actually need money. And I was just watching the BBC this morning that they're picking this up in Greece. And everybody's realizing, hey, we can barter all the things we need in our towns and villages and neighborhoods to conserve the supply of money, which, as you know, is being constricted with all of this austerity that's being demanded by the old financial system. So we really are in a whole new era now where the cooperative, open-source, information-based trading without money is growing very rapidly. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later, because the book you may have run into, the Wiconomics book and the Macroeconomics by John Pasker, are a good way that he's been mapping this. So very quickly, the 1980s were all about globalization and privatization, and the deregulation pushed by Ronald Reagan here in the U.S. and Thatcher there in Britain. And that became the paradigm, the Washington consensus, that model of development. And of course, it was also measured by GDP as the measure of progress. And we have to remember all the values subsumed under economics and money. The value of art, the value of leisure, the value of social networks, the value of the environment, all zero on GDP scale. And so just to remind us, I did this little schematic back in the 1980s to show what a distorted picture GDP gave, because all of these social and environmental costs which were caused by that economic model were all added in to GDP, and the costs of cleaning up pollution and all of that, all added in as if it was more, useful product instead of being subtracted, which is not what any normal person would want to do. So I was saying, hey, the net GDP is much, much lower. And, you can't just have it all in numbers. So that's how long I've been working on this. And then we got to the 1990s, and we had the global casino, the 24/7 trading of stocks and bonds and currencies. And remember, all based on taxpayer-funded infrastructure, satellites, communications, airports, transport, telecoms, global agreements, very important part of the global economy. And these are the kinds of agreements, the IATA, which is the International Airline Transportation Association, so that you make sure that all of the pilots are trained the same way, and all the airline tickets are written the same way, it's changeable. And the GPU, the Global Postal Union, which isn't oppressing anybody. It's run out of a little brownstone house in Switzerland, and you make sure that when you put a letter in a mailbox somewhere in the world, it's a pretty good idea that it's going to get to who it was intended for. And of course, later, the Internet, which was also all funded by taxpayers' money. And so then we had the era of financialization, which got going in the 2000s, where suddenly financial, quote, services sectors became bubbles. And those quants, the rocket scientists, they were mostly physicists, were brought out from academia to design all these so-called financial innovations. And we know all of these acronyms now, the credit default swap, the collateralized debt obligations, the mortgage-backed securities, the special investment vehicle, and the whole idea was to take those loans that used to be held by the local banks that originated them to the homeowner or whoever, but to take those loans and package them all up as a security, and then people on Wall Street, Goldman Sachs or wherever, would go and sell them to unsuspecting municipalities in Europe and to the United States. So really what was happening was the pyramiding of these electronic assets, similar to the pyramiding of the paper assets in the 1920s. And so the financial crises were inevitable. Latin America in the 1980s, long-term capital management in New York, Russia, 1998, there was Asia, 1997, 1998. Then the dot-com bubble. Argentina defaulted in 2002. And then the housing bubble burst 2007. And the banking bubble itself burst in 2008. So if this wasn't enough for us to realize that we had to transform and redesign that global casino, I don't know what was. So here's a list of all the bailouts, if you remember. I'm being very polite, talking about Northern Rock, I didn't mention the World Bank of Scotland, but that actually bailed out too. And then in the US, we had the TARP, the Troubled Assets Relief Program, $700 billion taxpayers' money. And then the Fed opened its discount window and began to offer big banks on Wall Street literally free money, which, of course, they were taking. And I remember I wrote an editorial at the time with the title, and we all thought that banks had money. We didn't realize that the taxpayers gave the banks money, and then they lent the money to us at interest. And so the Fed, you know, continued this process. Then they bailed out AIG, big insurance company, and then they bought all these toxic assets. And as my friend Ellen Brown, who's a wonderful lawyer in California, who wrote a marvelous book called The Web of Debt, and she has an article up on our website saying, hey, the Fed could have purchased city and state bonds, not just the corporate bonds and the bonds from banks. And if they had done that, our states and cities in the United States would not be having the financial crisis they are having right now, where they're having to fire policemen and teachers and firefighters. So the total amount of taxpayer money which was thrown into these bailouts, according to the U.S. federal government special investigator, is $23 trillion to the T. And we had a law which got passed called the Dodd-Frank Law at the end of last year, and it didn't really address the problems because we have so many lobbyists in Washington that many members of Congress would say, hey, you know, Wall Street owns the United States Congress. So what happened was the six biggest banks got bigger, they now control 60% of the U.S. finance, according to Simon Johnson, who wrote a book about it. All of this, you know, there's going to be a recording of this. You can get all of these PowerPoints later if you want them. So, of course, what happened was that 2009 was Wall Street's great year. And now, in 2010, we're dealing with the next level of the crisis, and which the financial community refers to as the pig, you know, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. And what they're saying there is that, look, we shifted our private debt to the government with the bailout. And, of course, what's happening now is the politicians have shifted those deficits to citizens. And the bond markets are saying, we're not going to take a haircut. We want the governments of these countries to impose austerity and cut public services and all the rest of it. And so naturally, citizens in all of these countries, including in the USA, are absolutely outraged. You know, A, they paid for the bailout for the people who caused problems in the banking sector, and now they have to pay again by losing their jobs and having all of these cuts in social services. So, this unfairness has been a constant problem that I've tried to address. And back in 2007, I helped organize a conference for the European Commission called Beyond GDP. And anyone who wants to look at the proceedings of that conference, we did it in the European Parliament, and there were about 700 or so MEPs, statisticians, and so on. And you can go to www.beyond-gdp.eu. And almost everybody there who was at that conference agreed that it was time to correct the GDP. President Barroso was there, and all of the top people sprinkling cold water on the idea. And what's happening now is that the real wealth, which is the public infrastructure, the environment, the education, healthcare, all of those things, were to be added in to GDP, which would have given a much better picture. And we're beginning to see this happening now in the European Union. And we did a survey, our company, Ethical Markets, did a survey at that time with GlobeScan, big public opinion firm in London. And we did it in 10 countries and found that citizens understood this by huge majorities. The citizens were saying, yes, of course, we need to have all of these other important indicators displayed, as well as just the money indicators, which are in GDP. So I found this cartoon, which is kind of what's happening in public opinion in the USA right now. We are very, very angry at our banks and foreclosing unnecessarily and charging all kinds of egregious rates on credit cards and student loans and what have you. So that gives you an idea of what's going on in the USA right now. The American dream has kind of turned into a nightmare for too many of our citizens. So with all this in mind, that we at Ethical Markets organized the Transform Finance Initiative, and the meeting was convened here last August with a group called the Capital Institute, with a professor from the Business School at the University of Notre Dame, and a group called Networking Action. And we all felt that as market participants, beneficiaries, as we all were, that we should take responsibility to promote the kind of fundamental restructuring that's really needed. And we based our recognition, and you can find our statement on our website, that finance has always been part of the global commons because it's all based on public assets, built platforms, and this was first recognized, of course, in 1945. Of the Bretton Woods Conference, where the rules governing global finance were first set up. But they're out of date now, and that's what we're really all about. So that global casino has become a sort of flywheel of destruction, social destruction and environmental destruction. And you're all aware of these fundamental flaws rooted in obsolete economic and financial models. EMH, that's the famous efficient market hypothesis that says that markets produce the right prices for assets, and that's all we really need. Markets can run societies efficiently and allocate capital, and of course it's quite wrong, and it became totally obvious with the crises on Wall Street that began in 2008. And another one is called modern portfolio theory. And of course, it's unbelievably out of date, not modern at all. And then these are the capital asset pricing models, and they give a very false picture as well of the value of companies. And then very simplistic risk management models called VAR, value of risk. And what we found was that everybody was using the same risk management model. So it was kind of, you know, creating systemic risk. They're all using the same model. My gosh, you know, when the model turns out to be wrong, they all go down like dominoes. So we realized when we met here that future financial crises were just absolutely inevitable, and that these markets have essentially become casinos. We have currency trading today that reaches $4 trillion every day, and that over 90% of that is pure speculation. And then the latest craziness, as you probably know, is the high-frequency trading, where they have this computerized trading, and they will trade the stock of a company 1,000 times a second. And we had the famous flash crash that took place in this country last May. And the shares of companies like Accenture, which were trading at about $40 a share, suddenly fell to pennies within a matter of minutes. And imagine those employees of Accenture who had their retirement funds in stock of that company. It bounced back a bit, you know, a few seconds later, but of course there's a big inquiry going on. And I wrote an article pointing out that that gambling is an addiction, and this kind of high-frequency trading is also an addiction. And so we based our whole premise on the fact that the financial system is improperly using public infrastructure, and that's, you know, the internet and satellite communications, all paid for by the public. And so basically, this statement, which is up on our website, on the homepage, has been signed now by 80 world-class experts, and it's now open for anyone to sign, and we invite any one of you that want to sign it to go to www.transformingfinance.net and please add your signature. And we began by saying, what's the purpose of finance? And what values and principles should be upheld? And what are the limits of markets and money? And how can finance serve equitable, ecologically sustainable kind of governance in the global economy? And how can knowledge, and maybe just leave alone traditional non-market-based societies, indigenous people, and I've met many of them over the years, who don't want to be part of the global economy. They prefer their own way of life. And how do we also reduce inequality and respect human rights? So that's all in our statement, as well as this statement, which we said markets must operate on trust, and these are the common principles that should be incorporated. Access for all participants who want to be part of it. Like a lot of people in Africa right now, there are many countries who are using cell phones to access the bank account. And acknowledging the intrinsic value of the environment and assigning rights to the environment. And decision making at the most local level possible. As you know, that big word that the EU uses, subsidiarity. And then a commitment to environmental sustainability and social justice, and co-governance with all the stakeholders, rather than have these arcane central bankers, you know, do everything behind the curtain. So the key operations of finance, as you know, are supposed to be to stabilize the value of national currencies, and make reliable global currency regimes. Channel savings into production and sustainable investment to build real wealth. Manage fail-safe and transparent payment settlement systems. And be appropriate, dependable, and transparent tools for managing financial risk, and so on and so forth. And we agreed, even though it isn't all in the statement, the ethical principles, the social mandate to serve real economy as intermediaries. You know, a lot of Wall Streeters got so arrogant that they kept on talking about financiers provide capital. Well, they don't. We have to remember that people in local communities work at companies and earn profits and income and put it into banks and save it, and then some of it is sent to places like Wall Street that are supposed to find good ways to invest it. And so we have to remember that financiers do not provide capital, they're simply intermediaries. And that's why a lot of the people who surrounded our meeting, a lot of people couldn't come, but were part of the effort. And Lawrence Kotlikoff, for example, has a wonderful book, and he makes a very good case, as does John Kay, who's there over there in Britain, that banks are simply public utilities, that they should be sort of boring, and they should provide a good living to bank personnel. But we have to remember that money cannot make money, only real effort by real productive people make money. And of course, the acknowledgement that we have to go beyond those GDP indicators. So the imperatives that we all felt were breaking up those two big to fail banks. And just this isn't a really dangerous thing to do. A lot of the big banks, when they spin off various divisions and come to a better size, actually become more valuable to their shareholders as broken up institutions than trying to manage these enormous institutions which are too big to manage, just when it's too big to fail. And then we, many of us, not everybody agrees with this, but this is many of us do, that we must bring money creation under public control. And my friend James Robertson in Britain has been writing about this and still does for many years. So among other economists, with a group called the American Monetary Institute in the U.S. And they have been pushing the need to take back the money creation from the private Federal Reserve system. Many people in the U.S. didn't really understand until recently that the Fed is not a government agency. It's owned by 12 private banks. And so this is why we really do need to bring the money creation back under public control. And then we think that fractional reserve private banking should be ended. And that means that every $100 that a bank has, which is made available to them through the Federal Reserve, that they can lend out again 9 times that amount, because the idea is, oh, well, not everybody's going to come and ask for their money out of their account, so we can, we can earn interest on this huge additional amount of money from that original $100. So we feel that this is part of the weakness of the system, and that the reserve should be much, much greater. And now, for example, the Chinese, they have much higher reserve requirements for banks. And instead of raising interest rates, they simply raise the reserve requirements if they want to cool down the economy. Much better way to do it. And I've been going to China since 1986. I'm very much familiar with the way their financial system works. And so we also said we want transparent and democratic central banks. I mean, there's nothing wrong with central banks if they really perform a service, a national service, but they have to be more democratically run, rather than our Federal Reserve, where everything is done, like a kabuki theater, behind the curtain. And we think that central banks and government agencies, like our Treasury, Bank of England, should enable cities and local communities to have their own currencies. Because when that began to happen after the Great Depression in the U.S., where every local city had its own currency, they call them tax anticipation notes, and you'll find a lot of that in my books. And the point is that back then, this was frowned on, and they tried to shut down these local currencies. But, for example, in Brazil, the Brazilian Central Bank specifically now encourages and allows cities and villages and local communities to have local currencies. A lot of them happened in Argentina. Argentina defaulted, and people began to realize that the national peso was less reliable than these local barter clubs and local currencies. And also, we discovered through the work of our colleague Emma Brown, who's also a Philadelphian, that we should allow regional public banks. And she did her research, and she was looking at all of the states in the USA, and they're all, include terrible deficits and cutting staff and all of this kind of thing. She found one state, North Dakota, that had a surplus and had no employment. And she found that that is because that bank is owned by the state, and you can go thought of this bank during the Great Depression, when the Wall Street banks, who owned all the mortgages on their farms, were foreclosing on their farms. And so they said, okay, we are going to have our own state bank. We won't operate inside the Federal Reserve System. We'd rather do it on our own. And so all of their local banks are funded through the Bank of North Dakota. And for schools and highways, they can borrow at no interest instead of having to go to Wall Street and float municipal bonds at high interest rates. So we've now started a public banking institute to promote this idea with Ellen Brown as our leader. And then the next issue is how to downsize financial sectors, because it got to be the point, as you know, that the City of London was about 25% of Britain's GDP. And what we know, finance doesn't really produce wealth. They just, all of this way of replicating money that does not give wealth. And so we've been promoting the idea of a low 1% financial transaction tax so that those high-frequency traders, it will really bite on them, but anyone who just buys stocks to hold won't be really affected by this. But it'll have to be done through the G20 so that these Wall Street firms won't say, okay, well, go offshore or go to the Cayman Islands. Whatever. So if it's done through the G20, then it'll, everybody will have to comply. And of course, there's a lot of discussion about reducing leverage and in capping those inflated bonuses. Very important is separating retail deposit banks from all the risk-taking, the proprietary trading. And that was a terrific fight. Some part of that got into the new law, but still not enough. And we really do need to ban naked short selling, which I don't have time to go into now, but you can find out a lot about many places. And these derivatives, the credit default swaps, and which are nothing really but the betting, and mostly betting that bonds will default, like the bonds of Greece or Ireland, and betting against the value of the euro. We don't need this kind of thing. It doesn't produce anything useful. And then we have to retrain bankers and portfolio managers in this new accounting model we call environmental, social, and governance as factors to be factored into the value of companies and pension funds and whatnot. And it means we also have to reform the rating agencies, because you know what happens when Standard & Poor's or Moody's announces to the press that they are going to downgrade the bonds of Ireland or whatever country it would be. This hits the real people in that country by raising the interest rates that the government has to pay on its borrowing. And then the institutional investors, meaning the pension funds, the charities, they really need to have much tighter oversight and accountability. And the problem is very well covered in this new center which Professor Paul Williams started. He's a former banker, and that's at the London School of Economics. And you can go on the LSE's website and see what he's talking about. We thoroughly support him and what he's trying to do there. So how did we come to this idea that global finance is actually part of the commons? Well, we began with the fact that this has been acknowledged since Bretton Woods in 1945, all the way through really to the 1990s. And the best work, theoretically on this, is a trilogy of books called Global Public Goods, published by Oxford University Press, by my good friend, Dr. Inge Carl, who is a German economist. And those books the second 2003 and the third 2006, and you can find those at Oxford University Press. And she laid out the theoretical understanding that there had always been a part of economic theory that talked about public goods. The case was the lighthouse, you know, that everybody had to chip in and pay for the lighthouse, and its benefit went to everybody. And she said, that was great, you know, in the old days, but now we have the need for global public goods since we have a global economy. So that's what those three books are all about. And then I wrote a paper, which you can find on our website, downloadable, of saying that there are lots of new markets, and there's also lots of new commons. I mean, the new markets are everything from sustainably managed forests to markets for pollution control equipment, to markets for green technology. And the new commons now are the oceans, the atmosphere, the electromagnetic spectrum. We never thought about these things until very recently. And back in 1968, the economics profession more or less took the idea of the tragedy of the commons, which was put forth by Garrett Harding in an article in Science magazine. And he was taking this idea really from classical economics, and the idea was, oh dear, if you have a village green, there will always be farmers who will want to put more and more of their sheep to graze on that village green, and the farmer that puts the most sheep on there will destroy the grazing and the grass for everybody. So that was the tragedy. But Eleanor Ostrom, who have been researching all of this for many, many years from a different point of view, a social point of view, said, well, the idea that the only way you can deal with what Harding called the tragedy of the commons is to assign private property to everybody. That was Harding's big idea. That the only way be to have property rights, and then people would take care of their property. But Eleanor Ostrom pointed out that every society in the world over the ages has developed right outside of the market and the economic system all kinds of rules for how to share the use of common resources like rivers and grazing pasture, things like that. And she won the Bank of Sweden Prize in 2010. Sometimes it will be referred to a Nobel, which it isn't. I can get into that later if anyone's interested. And so I wrote articles like one which you can find called Defending the Global Commons. And I and many friends of mine set up an NGO which we call the Global Commission for Southern UN. And what we were saying was that now we can tax all commercial uses of common resources, oceans and atmosphere and whatever, and fine people who overexploited them. And that book is still available. There it is. And you can still get it on Amazon. And we presented it at the UN Social Summit in Copenhagen in 1995. And the World Bank and the IMF were absolutely furious. And this was one of the diagrams I had in my lead article in there, because I edited this book. And I was pointing out that economists had a very different view, that only markets could be used to manage common resources. And, you know, that was how we got into this whole thing of cap and trade, to try to remove carbon from the air. And in my view, it's a very convoluted and stupid and ineffective way to try to remove carbon or keep carbon out of the atmosphere. Can't go into that now. And futurists have a very different view. They have a sort of open systems view. And they say, okay, if you do have divisible resources, you can use Adam Smith's, you know, Winman's rule of competition and private markets. But in closed systems like oceans and atmosphere, So you have indivisible resources, you must devise green resources. And they are about cooperation and agreement. And now, of course, something I'm promoting a lot, which is the green transition from the fossil fuel age to what I call the solar age. So what we're looking at now, which is very interesting, is all of these sectors of economic activity going on all over the world, quite outside the market economy. And whether it's civil society organizations or otherwise known as NGOs, they are all over the world, and many people now, at least 19 million people, are fully paid workers in this non-profit voluntary service sector. And of course, many societies, including the United States, have cooperatives, whether it is the growers of dairy products in the United States, many of them are cooperatively owned and run, or dairy fruit growers in cooperatives. So the cooperative model, which is also, you know, all over Europe, it's still very robust. And so we find that in countries like the Netherlands, 12.6% of all the payments of paid employment is in non-profit. In the UK, it's less than that. And then the whole new phenomenon, as you know, social network, whether it's, you know, YouTube or Facebook or Twitter or whatever, where people trade, transact, and exchange information and goods and all the rest of it completely outside the money-based old market. And then you have the open source movements in computers that are very cooperative. And the books that I recommend here are Yoichi Benger's book. He is he teaches law at Yale. And his book, The Wealth of Networks, explains all of this. And then, as I mentioned before, Don Pashkov, who's in Canada, and his two books, Economics, and the new one, which I highly recommend, Macroeconomics. And of course, I've been writing about that since Andrew picked up my first book, All Creating Alternative Futures, which was subtitled The End of Economics. And I was pointing out in that book, the love economy. And there it is. There's the love economy. This is the total productive system, and here's the private sector, the icing on the cake. We all must operate in the private sector if we can, but it rests on the public sector. And this is what economists add up into GDP, most of these cash-based transactions. But then, completely invisible to economists on the third layer down, which is the love economy, 50% of everything that's going on. And the bottom layer, of course, is Mother Nature's productivity. And if we exceed Mother Nature's tolerances, it goes back up into the paid economy as inflation, where we have to start spending money cleaning the water and the air, and so on and so forth. So the newest commons are global media, the internet, and, of course, as we were saying, the global financial system, but they're still being run by those old windmills rules. And so the task for all of us is how do we shift them to windmills rules? And that means going from economics to systems theory. And I really do mean the end of economics. And a lot of people now are beginning to agree with me. Even economists are beginning to agree with me and figure out how they can transcend that single discipline and connect all the dots in a more systemic model. And my friend Roberto Fabio, who founded Intercept Service, which is the syndication I use for my editorial, he has a wonderful article, which I believe we posted on Ethical Markets, on the social economy. And how huge it is, and of course how economists don't even notice it. Neither do the economists notice all these multiple currencies. And I have an article that you can find there on the politics of money. And so this is just I've been talking about this a little bit, but here's some more references. And where we are now is that we're really thinking very seriously about beyond scarcity-based money. Because the whole idea of scarcity came from the earlier industrial revolution and is still in old economics as product. And okay, if you have a chair or a table or a computer, then I can have it. And what we find now is that we move to an information economy. If you have information, you can give it to me, and you still have it, and I have it. So we are going now toward an abundance model, where the abundance comes from two things, really. It comes from the information age, where information sharing makes us all richer, and the fact that the planet is bathed in solar energy every day from the sun, and all we have to do is to get a little bit more efficient in collecting that solar energy with, solar panels, with wind turbines, with ocean wave technologies that are being pioneered there in Scotland. And so we now need a new currency which can be based on this true abundance. And so we're suggesting that it could be pegged to kilowatt hours rather than gold, that could be the kilowatt hour of electricity generated from solar-based sources. And I wrote an article called The Weekly Plan for Iceland, Britain, and the Netherlands, which takes the issue of Iceland's debt from its super banks to Britain and the Netherlands, and how easy it would be for Iceland to pay that with electricity from their geothermal sources, which are very close to the surface and easy to collect. Could be run through a high voltage transmission line to Scotland, probably to Glasgow, and then fed into the British and European grid. So this is kind of the new thinking. And then let's look at those scorecards. Because to finish, if we don't change scorecards, we are not going to steer our society into the healthier direction that we all have to go. And so I am thrilled that there have been all of these new indicators, and I have to say I have been involved in one way or another pretty much with all of these. This has been my passion. And by Friday of this week, we and the GlowScan are issuing a new survey. Now we've raised it to 12 countries, and we still find huge majority of ordinary people who understand, yes, for heaven's sake, let's correct GDP. And the reason it's so important to do that now is because GDP shortchanges those countries that are under the most pressure in Europe, like Ireland and Greece and Portugal, because they're not counting in the GDP the real wealth in those countries, the well-educated workforces, the efficient infrastructure, and the productive environments all counting for nothing in GDP. So that's what we're focusing on now. And you'll be able to find that survey after Friday at globescan.com or at ethicalmarkets.com. So I'm very hopeful that I see the success that we've had in socially responsible investing and how many more corporations now are using the social responsibility and sustainability model. And in the U.S., the total assets now in this kind of management are over $2 trillion. And the Global Compact of the UN, the 10 principles of good citizenship, is now about 5,600 companies around the world subscribe to those principles. And then the Calvert Group, which was one of the very first managing the socially responsible mutual funds, and I've been an advisor to Calvert from 1982 until 2004, when I left to start Ethical Markets, became a full-time media person. And our company is a signatory of the UN Principles of Responsible Investment, and they now account for $22 trillion of mostly pension fund assets that they realize they have to manage in a long-term way to deal with climate change and all of these other issues that we have to deal with. And then there's the Carbon Disclosure Project, which friends of mine started, including a wonderful Scottish friend of mine that many of you must know, Tessa Tennant. And she launched the Carbon Disclosure Project with Paul Dickinson, and now $64 trillion worth of companies have agreed to disclose the amount of carbon in their production process. And then Ceres, that's a group in the United States of pension funds that represents 3 trillion assets. And we have a new corporate charter, rather like the one that you have in Britain, the social enterprise charter. And so I see the changes happening now quite rapidly. And if you want to see a new book of case studies of sustainable social enterprise, we're very proud that we're one of the case studies in that book, doing our part in health. So we now have come to the end of economics and the rise of systems thinking. Everybody is admitting that macroeconomics fails. But microeconomics is still useful if all of those social and environmental costs are internalized on the company's balance sheet, then the rise of responsible ethical investing. And then the accountants have been doing a wonderful job. And they have evolved their model to this environmental, social, and governance standards. The granddaddy of them is the Global Reporting Initiative in Amsterdam. In Britain, there is the Institute of Chartered Accountants of England and Wales, and their wonderful editor of their journal, Richard Spencer, who was kind enough to publish a paper that I did with Richard Capra last year called Qualitative Growth, pointing out there's nothing wrong with growth. Because in every society, we've always thought something is growing, something is dying, and something has to be maintained. And so basically, you can download that paper if you're interested, and we launched it in the British House of Lords, and it seems to go down pretty well. And now we have the Nobel family finally dissociating themselves with that phony Bank of Sweden prize. It really has nothing to do with the rest of the Nobel in economics. It's never a science. Any economist will tell you that after a couple of drinks. And now, we don't need GDP anymore, which the macroeconomists have controlled, because now we have the internet, and we can go to websites where there's whole dashboards of indicators. So that whatever you're interested in, whether it's health or education or human rights or the environment, you can go to these websites, like Talbot Henderson's Quality of Life Indicators, and you can follow whichever one of those quality of life metrics that you're interested in. So we can't allow economists to control that game anymore either. So there's the Talbot Henderson Quality of Life Indicators, and we update them regularly at talbot-henderson.com. And so the stage is set for the global transition to sustainability. Isn't that exciting? And we realize all we have to do now is to end these perverse subsidies. We're still subsidizing the old fossil fuel industry and the nuclear power. And once we level the playing field and get rid of those excessive subsidies, and the G20 is already talking about this, then the green technology, solar, wind, wave power, will just race ahead much faster. And we realize now that there weren't really any black swans, that's the book that Nancy Taleb wrote, it was just the blindness of the financial community to these externalities. And so naturally, if you push them off your balance sheet, you're not going to notice them, and then they come back to bite you with climate change. So we're now going from cost to avoided cost. and social benefits. And so this means that this is why the conversation everywhere in the world is changing. Green jobs, green growth, leapfrogging old technology, the UN has the Green New Deal, and the Global Marshall Plan. So this is all of the new conversation, and I became part of the Climate Prosperity Alliance. And we were pointing out that there was a win-win Copenhagen, which was missed, and that is everybody thinks there should be a floor price for carbon. Forget about trading and turning the whole thing over to Goldman Sachs. Nobody wants to do that. But we should have a price on carbon and other pollutants. And what we all could agree on is the ramp up of investments in the green technology, the green transition. So that's removing the subsidies, and we use the Climate Solutions 2 computer model, which you'll find on our website. And it says that if we invest as a human family $10 trillion over the next 10 years, $1 trillion a year, we will have the down payment on the transition to the solar age. And we all point out this time is scarce, not money. There's plenty of money. There's the Green Transition Scoreboard, and our last update was $1.6 trillion already in the pipeline. And our new update, which will be coming out shortly, we're right on track. It's going to be about $2 trillion. So you know, we need this there. And thank you so much for listening. And let's get into some questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I've switched myself on. Thank you for that, Hazel. I think most people managed to hear most of that. We tested the system 3 times this week, and each time we tested, the sound was a lot better than that. So I'm a bit disappointed in the sound quality, but I think most people might want to hear more things. We've got about 15 or 20 minutes for questions now. Does anybody want to ask anything? I've got a roving microphone, if you can wait for that. Silence. First time ever. There were four or five different sections in there. I mean, there was a history of finance. We've got one at the back. Yep. Yeah. Thank you. Here comes a question. Here, are you there, Hazel? Yep. Here it comes.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned that one of the prerequisites for moving towards this commons is stabilising national currencies. I seem to recall that the Bretton Woods system, which we had up until 1971-72, disintegrated. I think it was assisted by Nixon's closure of the gold window.
Yeah.
You know, I want to ask, where is the stabilizing, where is the political will to stabilize currencies and perhaps introduce some kind of system that creates the kind of stability that you're advocating? Because I think political will, notwithstanding your mention of G20 and so on, you know, I think that the challenge that you pose, which I'm very sympathetic to, is enormously challenging. And I wonder if you'd like to make a few comments on that.
Yeah, well, I agree with you that it is enormously challenging, but I think that with the new media, if you look at what's been happening in Tunisia the last few days, this is a totally new phenomenon where citizens can come together and be empowered to demand change in a very, very different way than they ever have been before. I mean, we first saw this with the fact that there were about, according to various estimates, about 10 million people around the world who were demonstrating peacefully in cities around the Iraq war. And okay, they did not prevent it, but it sent a message, I think, to many, many young people about the possibilities. And if you saw all of those educated young people, the students in Tunisia, and everybody thought that Mr. Ben Ali, you know, was there for life, and literally, you know, in 2 days, fled the country. Now, what I see happening in terms of finance, which is unprecedented, is the amount of pressure for the first time in the United States has been brought to bear on the Federal Reserve Board. And there were 300 members of Congress being pushed by their constituents to open up and audit the Fed. Now, this never happened before. And Bernanke had to go on TV, and finally they did release a lot of information which they've been hiding about the extent to which they've been giving trillions of dollars to the big banks on Wall Street, who then turned around and bought treasury bills with it instead of lending it. And there was a perfect example about how the old paradigm, ordinary citizens got it. And they said, oh, well, it isn't trickling down. And Bernanke thinks that if he pours money into the top of big Wall Street banks, it's going to trickle down to Main Street and help people with loans. And so everybody kind of sees it in real time. And so you have this split now between the mainstream media and all of the alternative media like us on the internet. And yes, it's chaotic, and yes, it's kind of risky. I mean, it scares the old order to death, but what it is doing is putting a tremendous amount of pressure on the old financial system. And so the pressure is coming from the streets, from the people, who are quite justifiably outraged at the unfairness that's going on. And at the same time, the pressure is coming from the fact that they know that there will be another series of financial collapses unless they re-engineer the system. So it is tortuous, and I think that we as good citizens have to keep pushing. We can make it happen in ways that wouldn't have been possible a few years ago.
Okay. So I think there's agreement there with your point that it's difficult and tortuous, and the pressure is going to come from quarters that we don't normally think of as being directly related to finance. There's another question down here at the front.
I wish I could see you all. I know that
we're trying to run a cat.
Normally I can see you all, but yeah. I don't know what's happened there.
We've been trying to run a camera here, but it's not working.
But I can't see anyone else.
Yeah, well, I'm not the best looking person in the room,
very
sorry
nice
about that.
Nice to see you, Andrew.
It's a really daunting agenda that you're putting across. Huh?
Sorry?
Yeah. I think it's a daunting agenda that you're putting across. What I think is interesting is how, because the failure of the current banking system, there's been a growth in some alternative forms. I'm thinking of credit unions, which you got in Glasgow. I think a third of all households in Glasgow have got a credit union bank account.
Wonderful.
Because you can do a direct debit from your salary. We run in the council a loan guarantee scheme, which is available for companies that can get credit from banks. And I think we back it up from our own assets. But we're doing that as...
Congratulations.
Yeah, we're doing that as responses to failures, not promoting it as an alternative. So people save at the credit union alongside the bank account which they've got in Lloyds or Bank of Scotland. So how do you make that bridge? How do you take that response to a deficit and turn it into something rather larger? So I think people are thinking mainly, how do we use this alongside banking system rather than instead of it?
This is the exact approach which I believe is the best. To have this parallel system like the one that you're creating, the credit union kind of system, the alternative currency, the time banking, the farmers markets, all of the ways that, you know, the transition town movement. I think people sense that the big system the old system is out of control. I mean, when you've even got Mervyn King, you know, the head of the Bank of England, who came out with a speech which shocked all of the financial community in the City of London. So, you know, you have a lot of truth-telling going on. You know, I have often said that the information age morphed into the age of truth. And we need this age of truth. I'm a big supporter of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, because we have to have information to redesign these systems. So this is exactly the way to go, you know, where you have a rolling readjustment, and that this is a natural way for the old banks to shrink. We've had a movement in the USA called Move Your Money, people can move some of their assets out of the big failing banks and move it into credit unions. And we have a network of credit unions all over the USA. They've been there for years and years and years. And so people are doing this, they're voting with their feet. And this can be the kind of peaceful change that we need to see. We'll look back in a few years and we'll say, my gosh, this thing was being built from the ground up, wasn't noticed by the mainstream media. I mean, I've been writing about all of this alternative local stuff ever since my friend Schumacher wrote Small is Beautiful. And it's only in the last few months that mainstream media have been going looking at credit unions and examining people who are doing local currencies like the Berkshire, that the Schumacher Society does up in Massachusetts area, where they represent about 2 million in that local currency, and all the local merchants take it. And so I think we'll look back on it and see that it was the fact that nobody was paying attention in the mainstream.
Okay, so it's happening, we just don't notice it so much. At the back there, and then at the front, feet, and then over here.
Hazel, thanks very much. That's been inspirational and tremendously encouraging and uplifting. And if only people thought the right way and acted the right way, it would be great. So I suppose my question is about the role of regulation. And it seems to me that that is critical as we get from here to where we want to get to. And there are lots of anomalies in that there are some big banks that seem to conduct themselves reasonably well and remain solvent. There are some small building societies that have completely imprudent lending and get themselves into trouble. There are some venture capitalists who make a contribution.
I'm losing your I can't hear you very well.
It's okay, I'm picking it up, Hazel, so I'll relay the question to you once Andrew's finished.
Once I get to the point.
Yes, please.
Your question is about regulation, right?
And the question, I suppose, ultimately, is there a sort of hierarchy of engagement in regulation, global down to local? And is there any sort of emerging consensus as to what really has to be globally regulated for it to have an impact and be successful, and then moving down from that to national and more local forms of regulation? That's the sort of question that I'm interested in.
Excellent question, because this is real systems thinking, and we realize now that we're going through a whole system transition. And so as we are able and inclined, we need to keep our eye on all of these changes going on at every level and seeing how we can participate in various ways at whatever level is easiest for us. Now, there is a consensus emerging, as you know, around financial transaction taxes. In Britain, the group is called the Robin Hood Tax, people supporting the Robin Hood Tax. And there, you know, like Oxfam, a lot of the environment groups, AFAC in Europe, and we are big supporters of the financial transaction tax. But also you find lots of people now in the capital markets want a financial transaction tax. One of our partners, the Capital Institute, which is composed of a lot of people who were on Wall Street for many years, and dropped out when they saw how corrupt it was becoming. And they are now actively supporting and testifying the transaction taxes. So to me, that's a systemic, one systemic thing in which everybody can support. And it's very easy to do because everything is electronic. And, you know, there's no argument about it being too difficult. And, of course, the other reason that financial transaction taxes are so popular now is not only the original reason that we had with the Global Commission, where we realized that even a below a half of 1% financial transaction tax would have raised about $300 billion a year, which could have gone to health, education, and the Millennium Development Goals. You know, they came later. But I think that this is the other new factor is that governments now, who are dealing with deficits and cuts, suddenly realize, my gosh, this is a huge new source of revenue to fill the shortfalls that we have at every level of government. So I think that that one is sort of a no-brainer. And then at the national level, as I say, changing the scorecard is extremely important because when you use GDP to value the sovereign bonds of Greece and Ireland and Portugal, and you miss out all of the real value that's there, that causes the interest rates to be higher than they need to be. And if you change the scorecard correctly, which more and more statisticians are beginning to agree to, then with a stroke of the pen, you cut the apparent deficit to GDP ratio of those countries in half. And I've been preaching this for a long time. I've done seminars at the European Commission for years about this, you know, with respect to the Maastricht criteria. And I was saying, look, you know, just change the GDP and get it right and then declare victory. And the first time we really had an opportunity to implement that was when President Lula became President of Brazil in 2002. And I helped organize a conference called the First International Conference on Implementing Indicators of Sustainability and Quality of Life. And what was so great was we had about 700 statisticians there, business people, in Curitiba, which is a very forward-looking city in Brazil. And we took our report to the new finance minister that President Lula had appointed, who was a medical doctor, which is so great, because he didn't have all this economic nonsense in his head. And so he went to the IMF and said, look, we don't have, there is no asset account on GDP. And so all you're counting is the public debt that we invested in creating the schools and the roads and the airports and the hospitals. And you're not allowing us to count the assets that we created. And so we must have this asset account. So the IMF was furious, but they agreed to do it in the case of Brazil, because of course Brazil now is a very, very important country. And so what that did was turn Wall Street's idea of Brazil around on a dime. And suddenly Brazil becomes the darling of the capital market. It now, you know, its economy is in surplus, it has a terrifically powerful currency. And all of that was getting the indicators right. And you can do this at every level, like in the city of Jacksonville here. I got my inspiration from the Jacksonville Quality of Life Indicators that were done at the local level in Jacksonville starting in about 1985. So there's all kinds of regulations and the metrics that can be changed at every appropriate level of government. But that, you're absolutely right, that we do have to change the rules and the scorecard.
A couple of things there. I mean, so at the kind of international level, we're talking about taxes and regulations on transactions. then changing the GDP nexus. And in Glasgow yesterday we launched a new website called Understanding Glasgow, which is going to attempt to do exactly that. So we're coming to the end of our time, Hazel, but I've got a couple of people who do want to ask you questions.
Hazel,
are you still there?
Hi, Margaret Hennon here from Fife in Scotland. Thank you very much for your
call.
It's almost a follow-on from that discussion you just had about a particular concern I have right now around speculation in the food markets across the world and how this is pushing up food prices. Do you think we should be making a special case around certain commodities as well in terms of people's ability to speculate on their prices?
Totally, totally agree. In fact, you know, as a member of the UN Principles of Responsible Investing, I are always writing and going on their webinars and saying that it is actually unethical for pension funds to invest in commodities. You know, these commodity indexes where it's oil and food of all kinds. And it's not only speculating in food should be unethical. And I think that there again, that has to be a movement led by social networks and ordinary people and alternative websites to really shame our pension fund managers. I mean, I think it's absolutely shocking that they speculate in oil futures, because of course we know that oil is very closely related to food production because of pesticides and fertilizers and tractors and everything like that. But I think that because these are all generally put together in the ETF commodity funds, we have to just say to those areas of the capital markets where we know they have an ethical responsibility to be long-term investors, they have no right, I don't think, to invest in commodities like that. Neither should they be indulging in high-frequency trading, and they have to be outed. You know, it was shocking. I heard the other day that a very well-respected fund, Hermes, in London, which has been a leader in socially responsible investing, that they're going to commit some capital now to high-frequency trading. And okay, the excuse is, well, we have to find out what these people are doing. But high-frequency trading just has to be taxed out of existence. And it has to be declared to be illegal. Just like making short selling, making credit default swaps.
Okay, so thanks for that, Hazel.
We'll get together on that one.
Okay. But we've got a couple of people waiting to ask questions here, but I think we've run out of time. People are beginning to go. We like to let people go in time. So I want to thank everybody at Ethical Markets, particularly Hazel, for making that happen. I want to thank my friends and colleagues here for coming and staying and living with us through the exigencies of our first webcast. And I want to thank our colleagues in Fife for joining us and for contributing to Q&A too. And just to thank everybody concerned, thank you very much.